Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Thursday, August 20th reading of Newsmax. Trump says Iran will face most crushing economic operation ever. President Donald Trump on Wednesday announced what he called the most crushing economic operation ever taken against any country, warning that nations, financial institutions, and businesses that help Iran could face severe economic consequences. "I'm announcing the most crushing economic operation ever taken against any country," Trump said in a Truth Social post, according to Reuters. Trump said the effort would amount to an economic D-Day and warned countries against providing Iran with a financial lifeline. "I'm also announcing that any country that allows its financial institutions, businesses, etc., to provide any lifeline to Iran will itself face tremendous economic consequences," Trump said, according to Reuters. Trump did not immediately provide details about the measures he was announcing. The administration said it was prepared to intensify its economic pressure campaign against Tehran. Newsweek reported on Wednesday, citing CNN, that Trump was moving away from seeking a quick resolution to the war and toward a more deliberate strategy of sustained economic pressure on Iran. That strategy could include additional sanctions on Iranian oil networks and financial channels, as well as pressure on foreign companies and banks that continue doing business with Tehran. Reuters reported Sunday that Trump had vowed to hit Iran hard economically after Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said Washington would impose measures against Tehran that had never been seen as soon as the following week. Reuters reported that the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control has imposed sanctions on more than 1,000 people, vessels, and aircraft since Trump began his second term. Recent U.S. measures have targeted Iran's oil network, shipping insurers, entities involved in weapons procurement, and digital exchanges, according to Reuters. Reuters also reported that the administration could impose additional sanctions on Chinese teapot refineries that buy Iranian oil or on Chinese financial institutions involved in processing Iranian funds. China buys more than 80% of Iran's shipped oil, according to 2025 data from analytics firm Kepler, cited by Reuters, making Chinese companies a potentially important target for any expanded pressure campaign. Trump has previously said he could either allow Iran's economy to deteriorate or hit them really, really hard, according to Reuters. In an August 11th interview, Trump said Iran was already suffering economically and that the United States had control over Iranian assets that had been frozen. The administration's economic pressures comes as Iran faces significant domestic economic difficulties. Reuters reported Monday that Iran entered the war with high inflation, a weakening currency, energy shortages, and structural economic problems, and is now dealing with damaged infrastructure, disrupted trade, and lost production. Iran's annual inflation rate reached 66% in July, while consumer prices were 87.9% higher than a year earlier, according to Iran's statistical center, Reuters reported. Trump has repeatedly made preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon a central objective of his policy toward Tehran. His latest announcement indicates that economic pressure is likely to remain a major component of the administration's strategy, with the potential for U.S. action to extend beyond Iran to foreign banks, businesses, and governments that help keep Tehran's economy functioning. Report says Iran eyes military targets in Europe if Trump escalates the war, by Charlie McCarthy. Iran's defiant leaders have considered attacking U.S. military targets in Europe, the Financial Times reported. Iranian forces have assessed possible strikes on American assets in southeastern Europe, including Bulgaria, if President Donald Trump escalates the war, two regime insiders told the Financial Times. Cyprus has also been considered as a potential target for retaliation in the event of another U.S. offensive. The reported threats raise the prospect of Tehran expanding the conflict beyond the Middle East as the Trump administration maintains pressure on the Islamic Republic. Iran has examined U.S. assets in Bulgaria after the NATO member approved the use of Besmer Air Base by American refueling aircraft. Bulgaria's parliament authorized up to 8 U.S. KC-135 aircraft and 250 military personnel to deploy there through October 1 in support of U.S. operations in the Middle East, according to the country's official parliamentary record. Iranian commanders also have examined attacking subsea fiber optic cables in the Strait of Hormuz if fighting intensifies. Regime insider said Tehran's response would depend on Washington's actions. With one warning, Iran would place no limits on its response to U.S. aggression. Trump said Tuesday that there were no talks or conversations going on or scheduled with Tehran as negotiations over reopening the Strait of Hormuz remained stalled. Iran's increasingly aggressive posture comes after its leadership strengthened hardliners in top security positions. The Wall Street Journal reported Sunday that Tehran has expanded missile and drone production, increased the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps influence over the regular military, and prepared allied militias for a potentially wider confrontation. The regime has already warned Bulgaria that allowing American forces to use its territory could carry consequences. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi last month urged Sofia to reconsider hosting U.S. military aircraft, accusing Bulgaria of facilitating American aggression. Still, analysts caution that Tehran's ability to strike Europe directly has limits. Siddharth Kashal of London's Royal United Service Institute told the Financial Times that Iran's missile threat to European targets is real but limited, with longer-range strikes sacrificing payload and accuracy. The warnings nevertheless signal Tehran is considering dramatically raising the stakes if Trump orders further attacks, potentially transforming a Middle East conflict into a broader confrontation involving U.S. assets on NATO territory. U.S. forces hold open Hormuz as Iran targets tankers. The U.S. military has helped keep hundreds of millions of barrels of oil moving through the Strait of Hormuz during the war with Iran, providing a crucial outlet for Gulf crude even as Iranian forces continue attacking commercial vessels. Since early May, American forces have assisted roughly 1,000 vessels carrying about 500 million barrels of crude through the strategic waterway, according to U.S. Central Command. CENTCOM said the Strait of Hormuz is an international waterway and that Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps has no authority to dictate the routes used by commercial ships. The U.S. effort has focused heavily on the southern portion of the strait near Oman, where American forces have helped commercial vessels navigate while using warships, aircraft, and helicopters to defend against Iranian attacks. Shipping analyst Michelle Wise Bachman of Windward told the New York Times that about 4 million barrels of oil a day moved through the southern corridor in June, rising to roughly 5 million barrels a day in July. Before the war, about 15 million barrels of crude passed through Hormuz each day, according to the International Energy Agency. The flow remains far below normal. Reuters reported Wednesday that only 6 commodity vessels passed through the strait on Tuesday, including one very large crude carrier entering from the Omani side and 2 tankers exiting the waterway. That compares with roughly 130 ships a day that passed through Hormuz before the war, according to Reuters. The continued U.S. military presence has become a central part of President Donald Trump's broader effort to assert control over the strategic waterway. Trump has repeatedly asserted that the United States now controls Hormuz. Last week, Trump said the U.S. had total control of the strait and wrote on Truth Social, "I think we will keep it." He has also said he intends to make the strait a U.S. territory and recently posted a map on Truth Social labeling the waterway new U.S. territory. Those statements represent Trump's position on U.S. control of the waterway and do not themselves change the strait's internationally recognized status or the territorial waters of Iran and Oman. Iran has rejected Trump's claims and has continued asserting control over shipping through the strait. Tehran said Tuesday that it would keep the waterway closed to shipping until Washington meets conditions tied to an interim agreement, according to Reuters. The military effort has also come with significant risks. At least 15 ships using southern routes have been hit since early June, according to analysis of International Maritime Organization data cited by the New York Times. The attacks have killed and injured mariners, and a vessel was struck near the Omani coast this week, killing a crew member, according to the United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operation Organization. The latest attacks have reinforced concerns among shipping companies that the U.S. military's protection does not eliminate the danger. Two Emirati oil tankers were struck by Iranian cruise missiles in Omani waters in July, killing an Indian crew member and wounding eight others, according to Reuters. A DIANCOM tanker was also hit in the Strait of Hormuz on July 19th and caught fire, forcing its crew to abandon ship, according to maritime industry reporting. Iran retains the ability to threaten commercial shipping as well as oil and gas facilities in neighboring Gulf states. Mona Yacobian, director of the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, told the New York Times that Iran's threat to the strait will remain significant. Many major shipping companies have continued avoiding Hormuz because of the danger. The reduced traffic has contributed to higher shipping costs and continued uncertainty in global energy markets, even as the U.S.-supported flow of Gulf crude has helped prevent an even more severe supply disruption. Gulf producers have also sought alternative routes. Oil is being moved in greater volumes through pipelines that bypass Hormuz, while some tankers continue to use the southern corridor near Oman. The United Arab Emirates state-owned oil company, Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, or ADNOC, has been among the companies working to keep crude exports moving. ADNOC said 18 of its vessels had been attacked during the war, killing one crew member and injuring 20. The company said it is taking extensive measures to protect its personnel and assets and is adapting its operations to the changing security environment. The U.S. military faces significant logistical challenges of its own. Iranian attacks damaged the U.S. military's facilities in Beirut, forcing American forces to rely more heavily on Diego Garcia, a remote British territory in the Indian Ocean, for some resupply operations. The Navy has maintained a large force in and around the Gulf of Oman, including the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and numerous destroyers. The Lincoln has been deployed for months, placing additional strain on a Navy with only 11 aircraft carriers and limited capacity to keep multiple carrier strike groups deployed indefinitely. Despite the attacks on commercial vessels, U.S. Central Command has defended the operation. Captain Tim Hawkins, a CENTCOM spokesman, told the New York Times that attacks on individual ships do not mean the defensive effort has failed. The fact that commercial vessels are still moving through the waterway, U.S. officials argue, demonstrates that American forces have prevented Iran from completely shutting down the route. For the moment, that distinction is important. Hormuz is not operating anywhere close to its pre-war level, but the U.S. military has kept a significant amount of Gulf oil moving, despite Iran's efforts to restrict shipping. and as Trump continues to claim that the United States has control over the strategic waterway, the ability of American forces to keep even a limited commercial corridor open has become a major test of that claim. Trump signals new meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that he planned to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and said the Asian nation held 57 very powerful nuclear weapons. The remarks come as Trump ordered Pentagon officials to cut short joint exercises with the South Korean military, writing in a Sunday social media post that they sent a message to Pyongyang that was totally inappropriate and hostile to a country that, as long as Donald J. Trump has been president, has been unthreatening and respectful. During Trump's first term, Kim called Trump a mentally deranged U.S. dotard and threatened that he had use of a nuclear button on his desk. The leader's relationship cooled after face-to-face meetings in 2018 and 2019, including a brief exchange at the demilitarized zone between the Koreas, in which Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to step into North Korean territory. "I know Kim Jong-un very well, and he's going to be fine as long as we have a smart president," Trump told reporters Wednesday during a tour of the helipad he's constructing on the White House's historic South Lawn. "The fact that I get along with him, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. He has 57 very powerful nuclear weapons," Trump said. "They should have never allowed it. If I were president, I wouldn't have allowed it, but he's got them." There have been varying estimates by experts over the years on how many nuclear weapons North Korea has. In June, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute estimated that North Korea has possibly assembled around 60 warheads, possesses enough fissile material to produce at least 30 more. Kennedy Center details plan has told a federal court it will wait until at least September 8th before proceeding with plans to restore President Donald Trump's name to the performing arts complex as a legal battle over the Trump-aligned board. In a status report filed Tuesday with U.S. District Judge Christopher Cooper, Kennedy Center said its board approved signage that would identify the building as the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald J. Trump. If the Trump Kennedy Center funds reaches $100 million in donation, the signage would also say the center was endowed by the Trump Kennedy Center Fund. The board is also seeking to rename the complex's grounds, President Donald J. Trump Plaza. Cooper ruled in May that Trump's name has been illegally added to the building and ordered it removed. Representative Joyce Beatty, Democrat from Ohio, an ex officio board member challenging the center in court, urged Cooper to rule on the latest plan before September 8th, arguing the board appears prepared to implement them as soon as legally possible. "There is thus every reason to believe that defendants will attempt to effectuate some or part of this latest unlawful resolution at the earliest opportunity after September 8th, Beatty's attorney wrote. "Moreover, plaintiff is concerned that defendants already may have damaged the historic marble that lines the facade with their original desecration of the center's facade by attaching President Trump's name above President Kennedy's," Beatty's team continued. The two sides also dispute a tarp covering the building's facade. The Kennedy Center says it is necessary for construction, including protection of the marble, water testing, and structural repairs. Beatty's attorneys contend the tarp is being maintained to obscure the facade despite the court's order and raise concerns that the earlier installation of Trump's name may have damaged the historic marble. The filings also shed new light on the board's decision to close the Kennedy Center for 2 years for renovations. Delta Consulting Group evaluated full and partial closure options and recommended a 2-year shutdown, saying a partial closure lasting 4 years would increase costs, prolong disruption, and create safety concerns. Beatty's lawyers questioned the consultant's relevant experience and the board's decision-making process, noting that members received some material only 2 days before the vote. During the closure, major Kennedy Center programming will move elsewhere. The National Symphony Orchestra announced its 2026-27 season will be spread across 6 venues in the Washington region as it faces financial difficulties amid declining attendance and an artist boycott linked to changes at the Kennedy Center. U.S. national debt tops $40 trillion. The U.S. national debt has surpassed $40 trillion for the first time, marking a historic milestone in a borrowing buildup that has accumulated over generations. Through wars, recessions, tax changes, and the expansion of major federal benefit programs under presidents of both parties. The Treasury Department reported that total public debt outstanding reached about $40.047 trillion Tuesday, according to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. The number is striking, but the more significant measure for economists is debt held by the public, money the federal government owes to investors and other entities outside the federal government. That figure is approaching the size of the entire U.S. economy, with publicly held debt already exceeding 100% of gross domestic product, according to the Journal. The $40 trillion figure represents the cumulative result of decades of federal borrowing rather than the policies of any single administration. The United States has carried debt since its founding, when the young nation borrowed heavily to finance the Revolutionary War. For much of American history, however, federal debt remained relatively modest compared with the size of the economy and often rose sharply during wars or economic emergencies before declining during periods of peace and economic growth. That pattern changed substantially during the 20th century as the federal government took on broader responsibilities. Social Security became a permanent part of the federal budget, Medicare was established in the 1960s, and the government's role in health care, retirement benefits, national defense, and other areas continued to expand. Major national emergencies produced additional surges. Debt rose dramatically during World War II, and borrowing again accelerated during the financial crisis of 2008 and the COVID-19 pandemic, when Congress approved trillions of dollars in emergency spending and economic assistance. The Journal noted that the federal government has run an annual deficit every year since 2001, meaning it has consistently spent more than it has collected in revenue and has had to borrow to cover the difference. The result is that borrowing that once was heavily associated with wars and economic crisis has become a persistent feature of the federal budget. The New York Times reported Wednesday that the government is on track to borrow more than $2 trillion this year. A growing share of that borrowing reflects the cost of servicing debt accumulated in previous years. Interest payments have become one of the largest expenses in the federal budget, with the cost rising as the government carries more debt and refinances older obligations at higher rates. The fiscal pressures are increasingly visible in the bond market. The yield on the 30-year Treasury recently reached roughly 5.3%, its highest level in nearly two decades, according to the Journal and Reuters. higher treasury yields increase the government's cost of issuing and refinancing debt and can also influence borrowing costs for households and businesses. Still, investors continue to regard treasury securities as among the world's most important and liquid financial assets. The United States also retains a major advantage from the dollar's role as the world's dominant reserve currency, which helps sustain demand for treasury debt even as the government borrowing needs grow. The long-term outlook, however, is becoming more challenging. The Congressional Budget Office projects that if current laws remain in place, publicly held debt could rise to about 120% of GDP within a decade and roughly 175% within 30 years, according to the journal. Much of that projected increase is tied to the growing cost of Social Security, Medicare, and other programs, as well as rising interest expenses. The Trump administration is confronting those long-standing pressures while pursuing its own economic and fiscal priorities. President Donald Trump has made reducing government waste, encouraging economic growth, and strengthening federal finances among the administration's goals. The administration's Department of Government Efficiency effort sought significant reductions in federal spending, while the administration has also pursued increased revenue through tariffs. The New York Times reported that the administration has claimed more than $200 billion in DOGE-related savings, although the Government Accountability Office has raised questions about the reliability and transparency of some of those estimates. Tariff policy has also produced substantial revenue, although the administration has faced legal challenges to some of the tariffs, and the government is now issuing refunds to companies following court rulings. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has set a goal of reducing the federal deficit to 3% of GDP by 2028. Bessent has also argued that some current fiscal pressures reflect circumstances that could change, while policies encouraging business investment could strengthen economic growth and eventually produce additional tax revenue. In an interview with Newsmax, cited by the New York Times, Bessent pointed to spending associated with the war in Iran and tariff refunds as factors affecting this year's deficit. He also defended provisions allowing businesses to immediately deduct certain investments in factories and equipment, arguing that the policy could encourage investment and expand the economy's productive capacity. This is a hit now to the deficit, but we are creating productive assets for future growth, which will be paying taxes down the line, Bessent said, according to the New York Times. The administration's fiscal policies are therefore being implemented against a debt burden that was already enormous before Trump returned to office. Republican and Democratic administrations have contributed to the accumulation through different combinations of tax policy, military spending, domestic programs, economic stimulus, and emergency measures. The biggest challenge for lawmakers is that the largest components of federal spending are difficult to change quickly. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national defense, and interest on the debt account for substantial portions of federal expenditures. While lawmakers from both parties have generally been reluctant to make sweeping changes to popular benefit programs or enact tax increases large enough to eliminate the deficit. The aging U.S. population is expected to put additional pressure on Social Security and Medicare in coming decades. At the same time, interest costs can continue rising even without new spending because the government must continually refinance existing debt. For now, the size and liquidity of the Treasury market and the dollar's global role continue to give the United States considerable financial advantages. But the $40 trillion milestone illustrates the scale of the challenge confronting Washington. The debt has been built over decades and across administrations of both parties. Reducing its growth will ultimately require decisions about spending, taxes, economic growth, and the government's major benefits programs that extend well beyond any single presidency. Trump shows confidence in bond market seat cuts. President Donald Trump on Wednesday expressed confidence in the U.S. bond market, saying the country is doing well while calling for lower interest rates. Trump's comments to reporters came following a White House meeting with executives from cryptocurrency and financial technology companies. His comments aired live on Newsmax and the free Newsmax 2 streaming platform. On Tuesday, the yield on the 30-year Treasury bond rose above 5.3%, its highest level since April 2007, amid a global sell-off in government bonds that sent long-term borrowing costs in several major economies to multi-year highs. The president was asked whether Americans should be concerned. "No, I don't think so, because like I said, our country is doing so well despite interest rates," Trump said. "We have interest rates that are artificially high. They raise them for no reason. And you can't go out to the market when you have a Fed that's raising interest. You can't say, I want to pay 3 points less than what the Fed says you're supposed to be paying. I think we have a powerful country and we're powering through these ridiculous interest rates. They're ridiculous. Look, when our country is strong, interest rates should go down. When our country is weak, frankly, they should go up. But this country is strong." The Treasury Department announced Wednesday it will at least double the size of some of its purchases of older long-term government debt as it seeks to improve trading conditions. Beginning September 9th, the department will increase the maximum size of certain debt buyback operations from $2 billion to at least $4 billion per transaction. The increase applies to Treasury securities with roughly 10 to 30 years remaining until maturity. The department did not link the decision to Tuesday's rise in long-term Treasury yields. Trump was asked whether his administration is doing enough to stabilize the bond market. "Well, I think it is," he said, "but I mean it's very sad. Every time we do great, we announce great numbers. The interest rates go up, and they go up because they want to stop inflation. They should go down because the country is strong." The Federal Reserve's interest rate decisions can have a major impact on bond prices and yields. Trump has long pushed the Fed to lower interest rates, but policymakers have recently signaled greater concern about persistent inflation and the possible need for higher rates. Minutes from the Federal Open Market Committee, July 28th to the 29th meeting, released Wednesday, showed growing concern about persistent inflation, with many participants indicating that policy tightening would likely be necessary if inflation did not decline. Trump praised Fed Chairman Kevin Warsh, who succeeded Jerome Powell in May, but said the central bank's board is poisoned by politics. "I have to tell you, we have a wonderful chairman. I think he's doing a great job," Trump said. "The problem is he has a board, and it's a political board," Trump said. "People put in by Obama, Biden, and me, and there are quite a few members still left, as you understand. And so they vote to raise interest rates. I don't know if they're doing it because they think they're doing a good thing or because they like the politics of it. But my point is, years ago, 25 years ago, when the country announced good numbers, interest rates went down because we had a stronger country. Now, when we announce good numbers, the better they are, the worse it is for interest rates. If they just leave us alone, let the rates go down, we should pay the lowest interest rate. You know, every point of interest is $600 billion. Think of that. Every point of interest is $600 billion. 2 points means we make a fortune, but we keep driving it up. It's a very unfair system, and I've said it now for a long time. When our country does well, interest rates should go down. I mean every time. Russia puts our Connor Kennedy, the son of Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., was placed on Russia's international wanted list over allegations that he fought as a mercenary for Ukraine, according to Russian state media. Moscow's Basmany District Court authorized Kennedy's arrest in absentia, accusing him of serving as a mercenary with the Ukrainian armed forces, according to Russian state news agency TASS, the New York Post reported Wednesday. Kennedy, 32, could face 7 to 10 years in prison if convicted in Russia, according to the report. Kennedy publicly disclosed in October 2022 that he had secretly traveled to Ukraine and joined the country's International Legion following Russia's invasion earlier that year. Like many people, I was deeply moved by what I saw happening in Ukraine over the past year. I wanted to help. When I heard about Ukraine's International Legion, I knew I was going, and I went to the embassy to enlist the next day, Kennedy wrote on Instagram at the time. Kennedy said he told only one person at home where he was going and disclosed his real name to only one person in Ukraine. I didn't want my family or friends to worry, and I didn't want to be treated differently there, he wrote. Kennedy, who had no previous military experience, said he was initially inexperienced with firearms, but learned quickly. I was also willing to die there, Kennedy wrote, so they soon agreed to send me to the northeastern front. Kennedy did not initially tell his father or his stepmother, actress Cheryl Hines, that he'd gone to Ukraine, according to People. His family became suspicious after seeing credit card charges from Poland and Ukraine. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. later said his son's decision initially caused him concern, but that he was proud of him. He said to me, when he heard maybe a little bit of anger and concern, "Dad, this is what you taught me to do, to stand up for what I believe in." And I was like, "Okay," Kennedy Jr. said. "I'm very proud of this, of my son," he added. Kennedy Jr. said his son's position on the war differed from his own, and I knew his views about the war were not aligned with mine, although he's not naive at all about it. He'd been arguing vociferously for the U.S. intervention, and he didn't want to be one of these people supporting a war and sitting on the sideline, Kennedy Jr. said. Connor Kennedy spent about 2.5 months in Ukraine before returning to the United States and resuming his law studies at Georgetown University. He is currently listed as an associate attorney in the Los Angeles office of Weisner Baum. Russia has also placed other foreign volunteers accused of fighting for Ukraine on its wanted list, according to TASS. Taunts Nike as stock loses $200 billion in value, by James Morley III. Nike shares have fallen to near a 12-year low, wiping out roughly $200 billion in market value since the sportswear giant reached its pandemic-era peak in 2021. The dive came as weakening direct-to-consumer sales added to the company's years-long stock decline. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican from Texas, seized on the stock decline to renew his criticism of the company over past controversies involving former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick and Nike's decision not to release a Betsy Ross-themed sneaker in 2019. Sad and predictable, Cruz wrote on X, saying Nike's decision to scrap the shoe was how the company lost me. For my whole life, I wore nearly 100% Nike for athletic wear, Cruz said. Kaepernick pissed me off, but when they canceled the Betsy Ross shoe, it showed that their marketing plan was America hate. I went out and bought brand new shoes, shorts, and T-shirts. Turns out I wasn't the only one, Cruz continued. Shares closed at $39.09 on Monday, August 17th, down roughly 78% from their November 2021 monthly closing high of $169.15. Market strategist Charlie Bilo has described the slide as the largest drawdown in Nike history as a public company. Nike has struggled with the direct-to-consumer strategy it spent years developing as a major growth engine. Nike direct revenue fell 7% in the company's fiscal fourth quarter, while digital sales dropped 12%, according to Nike's earnings release. Cruz was among conservatives who called for a Nike boycott in 2019 after the company abandoned plans for the Betsy Ross-themed sneaker. Kaepernick, who had previously drawn the ire of conservatives for kneeling during the national anthem to protest perceived police brutality, reportedly urged Nike not to release the product. The sports giant's decision to abandon the product following Kaepernick's objections started the company down a trend of embracing left-leaning causes while simultaneously alienating some conservative consumers, according to critics, contributing to the precarious position it finds itself this week. CDC says COVID infections likely rising in 50 states. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, COVID-19 infections are likely growing in all 50 states, with no state showing declining infections as of mid-August, The Hill reported. Despite the trend, the CDC says severe cases remain rare and emergency department visits linked to COVID are very low. The CDC tracks the virus through wastewater testing, which can detect COVID-19 in a community, even among people who feel healthy. Hawaii and Mississippi are listed as having moderate levels of COVID-19 in wastewater, though Mississippi's data is limited. Alabama, Alaska, California, Florida, Georgia, Oregon, Nevada, Texas, and Washington show low wastewater levels, while the rest of the states are classified as very low, The Hill reported. The CDC also tracks influenza and RSV through wastewater, both of which are showing up less frequently than COVID-19. An updated COVID-19 vaccine targeting the XFG variant is expected to be available this fall. The CDC has acknowledged limitations in the modeling behind that estimate. The agency states the measure, known as RT, shows only the direction of infection trends and does not reflect the verified number of cases. The estimate is built using emergency department visit data rather than confirmed case counts, and the agency notes it can be skewed by shifts in testing rates, changes in reporting, or changes in how severe infections are. Eric Trump says Natalie Harp is a genuinely good person, by Jim Mishler. Eric Trump said Wednesday that the conversation surrounding the relationship between longtime White House aide Natalie Harp and his father, President Donald Trump, was absolute trash. Natalie is an incredible young woman, a cancer survivor, a genuinely good person, and arguably one of the hardest working people in the White House. She's deeply committed to my father, to her job, and to this country, Eric wrote in a post on X. At CNN continues to be a joke, he added in response to comments made by Harp's estranged brother during a CNN interview Tuesday night. Host Aaron Burnett detailed an incident from October 2023 in which Harp reportedly climbed into the rear cargo area of a support truck in President Trump's motorcade after being told there were no seats left for her. Preston Harp called the incident actually kind of sad. That's like an unhealthy obsession, he said. Natalie Harp is a frequent companion to President Trump on golfing trips and at Mar-a-Lago. She is also often seen with the president, occasionally bringing along a printer to pass him information in hard copy, and stays late to draft his social media posts. Natalie Harp fought bone cancer in 2019 and reportedly sent letters to President Trump describing him as her guardian and protector in this life, while he wrote back praising her battle with the disease. Natalie Harp said legislation the president signed in 2018 granted her access to experimental treatments. The proximity between the White House aide and the president drew national attention when Senator John Ossoff, Democrat from Georgia, criticized the relationship at a Sunday rally in Atlanta. "If he doesn't want to do the job, he wants to build his ballroom and travel with Natalie on their apparently defenseless flying palace gifted by the Emir of Qatar," Ossoff wrote. In a Monday interview with MS Now's Jen Psaki, Ossoff said he could have said similar things about other senior White House aides. "They're not telling him what he needs to hear," he said. "They're telling him what he wants to hear, and the nation is at war, and we cannot afford that." Child care aid wait lists triple to 400,000 children. By Nicole Weatherholtz. About 400,000 children were on waiting lists for government child care assistance nationwide in the second half of 2025, more than triple the number reported less than 2 years earlier, according to a recent report from the National Women's Law Center. The group said about 118,800 children were on waiting lists in early 2024. 17 states have waiting lists or have stopped accepting new applications, although availability can vary by county in states with locally administered programs. The growing backlog comes as child care costs rise and states adjust to the expiration of billions of dollars in pandemic-era federal funding. The Federal Child Care and Development Fund, the federal government's primary child care subsidy program for lower-income working families, serves more than 1.6 million children in a typical month, according to federal data. But a Government Accountability Office report found just 22% of children eligible under their state's rules received assistance in a typical month. Child care costs rose 29% between 2020 and 2024, according to Child Care Aware of America. At the same time, roughly $39 billion from the American Rescue Plan was directed toward child care programs during the pandemic, according to Child Care Aware. States were required to use those funds by September 2024. In Texas, Valentina Sousa remains on a waiting list after applying in March for assistance for her 18-month-old daughter, Amia Sousa, told NPR she earns about $300 a week working part-time as a real estate assistant, while the cheapest child care she found cost $975 a month. "I'm also living at my mom's house, so if I can't even pay for rent, how am I also going to do both or even one right now?" she said. Texas had more than 93,000 children on child care assistance waiting lists as of January 2025, according to state data cited by NPR. Oregon faces a similar crunch, with about 26,000 children waiting for assistance after the state established a statewide waiting list in 2023, according to Oregon Department of Early Learning and Care. Oregon really has chosen to focus on maintaining that quality of programming that works well for providers and families by keeping those copays low, paying providers well, Department Director Alisa Chatterjee told NPR. "That means we have to serve fewer families with the resources available." The Trump administration, meanwhile, has reversed Biden-era mandates requiring states to cap family copayments at 7% of household income and make advance payments to providers based on enrollment. The Administration for Children and Families said the change gives states more control over limited federal dollars, allowing states to halt costly implementation efforts and redirect funds towards serving additional children, including getting more children off wait lists and into child care. States remain free to retain the previous policies, according to the agency. Advocates say further federal, state, and local funding will be needed to substantially reduce the backlog. When we all have a piece of the pie, then we can really actually get our wait lists down to a manageable level and actually get families the care that they need, Kim Coffran, Executive Director of Early Childhood Education at the Texas nonprofit Children at Risk, told NPR. mRNA melanoma vaccine reduced recurrence and spread. Merck and Moderna said on Wednesday a study of a personalized mRNA vaccine combined with the immunotherapy drug Keytruda reduced skin cancer recurrence and spread compared with Keytruda alone. The first positive late-stage trial results for an mRNA cancer vaccine. Shares of Moderna rose 40%, while Merck climbed 2% in pre-market trading. This trial is ongoing, but interim results found the treatment, known as Intismeran, met both its primary target of reducing cancer recurrence and its secondary goal of keeping cancers from spreading to other parts of the body. The treatment combines Merck's Keytruda with a made-to-order mRNA vaccine from Moderna that is based on an analysis of mutations found in the patient's own tumors. The trial enrolled 1,137 high-risk patients with stage 2B or 4 through 4 melanoma that had been surgically removed. Volunteers were randomized to receive up to 9 doses of Keytruda plus the personalized vaccine or Keytruda alone for about 1 year. The company said no new safety signals have emerged in the trial. In January, the companies announced results of a mid-stage trial of the treatment showing that it reduced the risk of recurrence or death by 49% after 5 years. The company said they will present their results at an upcoming medical meeting and share them with regulators. Melanoma is the deadliest form of skin cancer. In 2023, there were more than 1.5 million people in the U.S. living with melanoma, according to the National Cancer Institute. Stars and Stripes publisher retires in Pentagon rift. The longtime publisher of Stars and Stripes has announced his retirement, ending a decades-long career with the military newspaper as Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's Pentagon moves to exert editorial control and eliminate what it asserts are woke distractions. Max D. Lederer Jr. announced his retirement effective at the end of September in a memo to staff on Tuesday, as well as in an interview with Stars and Stripes. In the memo, seen by the Associated Press, Lederer, the second full-time civilian in the position, wrote that it had become clear that my philosophy of leadership and my understanding of the value and mission of Stars and Stripes differ in fundamental ways from the direction the leadership of the Department of Defense has for the organization. The announcement comes less than 4 months after the Pentagon fired Jacqueline Smith, ombudsman for the newspaper, whose job was to safeguard editorial independence. The news outlet is partly funded by the Defense Department, but has a legacy of independence from military and government leadership. No one should be surprised that they're kicking out the one person charged by Congress with the protecting Stars and Stripes editorial independence, Smith wrote in a column. Stars and Stripes has recently been at the forefront of some of the reporting on conditions for sailors on the USS Abraham Lincoln and concerns for their mental health during the aircraft carrier's long deployment, concerns that President Donald Trump has downplayed. The Pentagon did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Lederer's retirement, which comes 7 months after the department announced in a social media post that it would essentially overhaul the newspaper to align with its current messaging. Hegseth's spokesman, Sean Parnell, wrote on X in January that the Pentagon is returning Stars and Stripes to its original mission, reporting for our warfighters. He said the department will refocus its content away from woke distractions. Stars and Stripes will be custom tailored to our warfighters, Parnell wrote. It will focus on warfighting, weapons systems, fitness, lethality, survivability, and all things military. No more repurposed DC gossip columns, no more Associated Press reprints, Parnell wrote. More broadly, the development of Stars and Stripes come against a backdrop of increased efforts by Hegseth to control media coverage of the department. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe and thank you for listening.